Apology accepted. No worries. Cool. She looked relieved. Her avatar's facial expressions were extremely realistic, which usually meant they were synced to those of their operator instead of controlled by software. She must have been using an expensive rig. I was just a little freaked to find you here, she said. I mean, I knew someone would find this place eventually, just not this quickly. I've had this tomb all to myself for a while now. How long? I asked, not really expecting her to say. She hesitated, then began to ramble. 3 weeks, she said, exasperated. I've been coming here for 3 freaking weeks, trying to beat that stupid lich at that asinine game, and his AI is ridiculous. I mean, you know, I'd never even played Joust before this, and now it's driving me out of my gourd. I swear, I was this close to beating his ass a few days ago, but then, she raked her fingers through her hair in frustration. Ah! I can't sleep! I can't eat! My grades are going down the tubes because I've been ditching to practice Joust! I was about to ask if she went to school here on Ludus, but she continued to talk, faster and faster, as if a floodgate had opened in her brain. The words just poured out of her. She was barely pausing to breathe. And I came here tonight thinking this would be the night I finally beat that bastard and get the copper key. But when I got here, I saw that someone had already uncovered the entrance. So I realized my worst fear had finally come true. Someone else had found the tomb. So I ran all the way down here, totally freaking out. I mean, I wasn't too worried because I didn't think anyone could possibly beat a Sararak on their first try. But still... She paused to take a deep breath and stopped abruptly. Sorry, she said a second later. I tend to ramble when I'm nervous or excited. And right now, I'm sort of both because I've been dying to talk to someone about all of this, but obviously I couldn't tell a soul, right? You can't just mention in casual conversation that you... She cut herself off again. Man, I'm such a motor mouth, a jabberjaw, a flibbertigibbet. She mimed, zipping her lips, locking them and tossing away the imaginary key. Without thinking, I mimed grabbing the key out of the air and unlocking her lips. This made her laugh, an honest, genuine laugh that involved a fair amount of snorting, which made me laugh too. She was so charming. Her geeky demeanor and hyperkinetic speech pattern reminded me of Jordan, my favorite character in Real Genius. I'd never felt such an instant connection with another person, in the real world or in the Oasis, not even with H. I felt lightheaded. When she finally got her laughter under control, she said, "I really need to set up a filter to edit out that laugh of mine." No, you shouldn't, I said. It's a pretty great laugh, actually. I was wincing at every word coming out of my mouth. I have a dorky laugh, too. Great, Wade, I thought. You just called her laugh dorky. Real smooth. But she just gave me a shy smile and mouthed the words, "Thank you." I felt a sudden urge to kiss her. Simulation or not, I didn't care. I was working up the courage to ask for her contact card when she stuck out her hand. I forgot to introduce myself, she said. I'm Artemis. I know, I said, shaking her hand. I'm actually a huge fan of your blog. I've been a loyal reader for years. Seriously? Her avatar actually seemed to blush. I nodded. It's an honor to meet you, I said. I'm Parzival. I realized that I was still holding her hand and made myself let go. Parzival, eh? She tilted her head slightly. Named after the Knight of the Round Table who found the Grail, right? Very cool. I nodded, now even more smitten. I almost always had to explain my name to people. And Artemis was the Greek goddess of the hunt, right? Right, but the normal spelling was already taken, so I had to use elite spelling with a number 3 in place of the E. I know, I said. You mentioned that once on your blog. 2 years ago. I almost cited the date of the actual blog entry before I realized it would make me sound like even more of a cyber-stalking super creep. You said that you still run into noobs who pronounce it Art-Threemis. That's right, she said, grinning at me. I did. She stretched out a racing-gloved hand and offered me one of her contact cards. You could design your card to look like just about anything. Artemis had coded hers to look like a vintage Kenner Star Wars action figure still in the blister pack. The figure was a crude plastic rendering of her avatar, with the same face, hair, and outfit. Tiny versions of her guns and sword were included. Her contact info was printed on the card above the figure. Artemis, 52nd level warrior, mage. Vehicle sold separately. On the back of the card were links to her blog, email, and phone line. Not only was this the first time a girl had ever given me her card, it was also, by far, the coolest contact card I had ever seen. This is, by far, the coolest contact card I have ever seen, I said. Thank you. I handed her one of my own cards, which I'd designed to look like an original Atari 2600 adventure cartridge with my contact info printed on the label. Parzival, 10th level warrior. Use with joystick controller. This is awesome, she said, looking it over. What a wicked design. Thanks, I said, blushing under my visor. I wanted to propose marriage. I added her card to my inventory, and it appeared on my item list, right below the copper key. Seeing the key listed there snapped me back to reality. What the hell was I doing standing here making small talk with this girl when the first gate was waiting for me? I checked the time, less than 5 minutes until midnight. Listen, Artemis, I said. It was truly awesome to meet you. But I gotta get going. The server is about to reset, and I want to clear out of here before all of those traps and undead respawn. Oh. Okay. She actually sounded disappointed. I should probably prepare for my joust match anyway. But here, let me hit you with a cure serious wound spell before you go. Before I could protest, she laid a hand on my avatar's chest and muttered a few arcane words. My hit point counter was already at maximum, so the spell had no effect. But Artemis didn't know that. She was still under the assumption that I'd had to fight the Lich. There you go, she said, stepping back. Thanks, I said. But you shouldn't have. We're competitors, you know? I know, but we can still be friends, right? I hope so. Besides, the third gate is still a long way off. I mean, it took 5 years for the two of us to get this far. And if I know Halliday's game design strategy, things are just going to get harder from here on out. She lowered her voice. Listen, are you sure you don't want to stick around? I bet we can both play at once. We can give each other jousting tips. I've started to spot some flaws in the king's technique. Now I was starting to feel like a jerk for lying to her. That's a really kind offer, but I have to go. I searched for a plausible excuse. I've got school in the morning. She nodded, but her expression shifted back to one of suspicion. Then her eyes widened as though an idea had just occurred to her. Her pupils began to dart around, focused on the space in front of her, and I realized she was looking something up in a browser window. A few seconds later, her face contorted in anger. You lying bastard, she shouted. You dishonest sack of crap. She made her web browser window visible to me and spun it around. It displayed the scoreboard on Halliday's website. In all the excitement, I'd forgotten to check it. It looked just as it had for the past 5 years, with one change. My avatar's name now appeared at the very top of the list, in first place, with a score of 10,000 points beside it. The other 9 slots still contained Halliday's initials, JDH, followed by zeros. "Holy shit," I muttered. When Anorak had handed me the copper key, I'd become the first Gunter in history to score points in the contest. And, I realized, since the scoreboard was viewable to the entire world, my avatar had just become famous. I checked the newsfeed headlines just to be sure. Every single one of them contained my avatar's name. Stuff like, "Mysterious Avatar Parzival Makes History," and "Parzival Finds Copper Key." I stood there in a daze, forcing myself to breathe. Then Artemis gave me a shove, which, of course, I didn't feel. She did knock my avatar backward a few feet, though. "You beat him on your first try?" she shouted. I nodded. "He won the first game, but I won the last two. Just barely, though." "Shit!" she screamed, clenching her fists. "How in the hell did you beat him on your first try?" I got the distinct impression she wanted to sock me in the face. "It was pure luck," I said. "I used to play Joust all the time against a friend of mine, so I'd already had a ton of preparation. I'm sure if you'd had as much practice..." "Please," she growled, holding up a hand. "Do not patronize me, okay?" She let out what I can only describe as a howl of frustration. "I don't believe this. Do you realize I've been trying to beat him for 5 goddamn weeks?" "But a minute ago, you said it was 3 weeks. Don't interrupt me." She gave me another shove. "I've been practicing Joust nonstop for over a month now. I'm seeing flying ostriches in my goddamn sleep." "That can't be pleasant." "And you just walk in here and nail it on the first try." She started pounding her fist into the center of her forehead, and I realized she was pissed at herself, not me. "Listen," I said, "it really was luck. I've got a knack for classic arcade games. That's my specialty." I shrugged. "Stop hitting yourself like Rain Man, okay?" She stopped and stared at me. After a few seconds, she let out a long sigh. "Why couldn't it be Centipede? Or Ms. Pac-Man? Or Burger Time? Then I'd probably have already cleared the first gate by now." "Well, I don't know about that," I said. She glared at me a second, then gave me a devilish smile. She turned to face the exit and began to execute a series of elaborate gestures in the air in front of her while whispering the words of some incantation. "Hey," I said, "hold on a sec. What are you doing?" But I already knew. As she finished casting her spell, a giant stone wall appeared, completely covering the chamber's only exit. Shit, she'd cast a barrier spell. I was trapped inside the room. "Oh, come on," I shouted. "Why did you do that?" "You seem to be in an awful big hurry to get out of here. My guess is that when Anorak gave you the copper key, he also gave you some sort of clue about the location of the first gate, right? That's where you're headed next, isn't it?" "Yeah," I said. I thought about denying it, but what was the point now? "So, unless you can nullify my spell, and I'm betting you can't, Mr. 10th level warrior, that barrier will keep you in here until just after midnight when the server resets. All of those traps you disarmed on your way down here will reset. That should slow down your exit considerably." "Yes," I said, "it will. And while you're busy making your way back up to the surface, I'll have another shot at defeating a Sararak. And this time, I'm going to destroy him. Then, I'll be right behind you, mister." I folded my arms. If the king has been beating your ass for the past 5 weeks, what makes you think you're finally going to win tonight? Competition brings out the best in me, she replied. It always has. And now, I've got some serious competition. I glanced over at the magical barrier she'd created. She was over 50th level, so it would remain in existence for the spell's maximum duration, 15 minutes. All I could do was stand there and wait for it to dissipate. You're evil, you know that? I said. She grinned and shook her head. Chaotic neutral, sugar. I grinned back at her. I'm still going to beat you to the first gate, you know. Probably, she said. But this is just the beginning. You'll still have to clear it. And there are still 2 more keys to find and 2 more gates to clear. Plenty of time for me to catch up with you and then leave you in the dust, ace. We'll see about that, lady. She motioned to the window displaying the scoreboard. You're famous now, she said. You realize what that means, don't you? I haven't had much time to think about it yet. Well, I have. I've been thinking about it for the past 5 weeks. Your avatar's name on that scoreboard is going to change everything. The public will become obsessed with the contest again, just like when it first began. The media is already going berserk. By tomorrow, Parzival will be a household name. That thought made me a little queasy. You could become famous in the real world, too, she said, if you reveal your true identity to the media. I'm not an idiot. Good, because there are billions of dollars up for grabs, and now everyone is going to assume you know how and where to find the egg. There are a lot of people who would kill for that information. I know that, I said, and I appreciate your concern, but I'll be fine. But I didn't feel fine. I hadn't really considered any of this, maybe because I'd never really believed I would actually be in this position. We stood there in silence, watching the clock and waiting. What would you do if you won? She suddenly asked. How would you spend all that money? I had spent a lot of time thinking about that. I daydreamed about it all the time. H and I had made absurd lists of things we would do and buy if we won the prize. I don't know, I said. The usual, I guess. Move into a mansion, buy a bunch of cool shit. Not be poor. Wow, big dreamer, she said. And after you buy your mansion and your cool shit, what will you do with the $130 billion you'll have left over? Not wanting her to think I was some shallow idiot, I impulsively blurted out what I'd always dreamed of doing if I won. It was something I'd never told anyone. I'd have a nuclear-powered interstellar spacecraft constructed in Earth's orbit, I said. I'd stock it with a lifetime supply of food and water, a self-sustaining biosphere, and a supercomputer loaded with every movie, book, song, video game, and piece of artwork that human civilization has ever created, along with a standalone copy of The Oasis. Then, I'd invite a few of my closest friends to come aboard, along with a team of doctors and scientists, and we'd all get the hell out of Dodge, leave the solar system, and start looking for an extrasolar Earth-like planet. I hadn't thought this plan all the way through yet, of course. I still had a lot of details to work out. She raised an eyebrow. That's pretty ambitious, she said. But you do realize that nearly half the people on this planet are starving, right? I detected no malice in her voice. She sounded like she genuinely believed I might not be aware of this fact. Yes, I know, I said defensively. The reason so many people are starving is because we've wrecked the planet. The Earth is dying, you know. It's time to leave. That's a pretty negative outlook, she said. If I win that dough, I'm going to make sure everyone on this planet has enough to eat. Once we tackle world hunger, then we can figure out how to fix the environment and solve the energy crisis. I rolled my eyes. Right, I said. And after you pull off that miracle, you can genetically engineer a bunch of smurfs and unicorns to frolic around this new perfect world you've created. I'm being serious, she said. You really think it's that simple? I said. that you can just write a check for $240 billion and fix all the world's problems? I don't know. Maybe not. But I'm going to give it a shot. If you win. Right. If I win. Just then, the Oasis server clock struck midnight. We both knew the second it happened because the throne reappeared atop the dais along with the Sararak. He sat there motionless, looking just like he did when I'd first entered the room. Artemis glanced up at him, then back at me. She smiled and gave me a small wave. "I'll see you around, Parzival." "Yeah," I replied. "See ya." She turned and began to walk toward the dais. I called after her. "Hey, Artemis?" She turned back. For some reason, I felt compelled to help her, even though I knew I shouldn't. "Try playing on the left side," I said. "That's how I won. I think he might be easier to beat if he's playing the stork." She stared at me for a second, possibly trying to gauge whether I was messing with her. Then she nodded and ascended the dais. A Sararak came to life as soon as she set foot on the first step.
"Greetings, Artemis," his voice boomed. "What is it that you seek?"
I couldn't hear her reply. But a few seconds later, the throne transformed into the joust game, just as it had earlier. Artemis said something to the lich, and the two of them switched sides so that she was on the left. Then they began to play. I watched them play from a distance until a few minutes later, when her barrier spell dissipated. I cast one last glance up at Artemis, then threw open the door and ran out. Chapter 10. It took me a little over an hour to make my way back through the tomb and up to the surface. The instant I crawled outside, a messages waiting indicator began to flash on my display. I realized then that Halliday had placed the tomb inside a null communication zone, so no one could receive calls, texts, or email while they were inside, probably to prevent Gunters from calling for help or advice. I checked my messages and saw that H had been trying to reach me since the moment my name appeared on the scoreboard. He'd called over a dozen times and had also sent several text messages asking me what in the sweet name of Christ was going on and screaming at me in all caps to call him back right now. Just as I'd finished deleting these messages, I received another incoming call. It was H trying once again to reach me. I decided not to pick up. Instead, I sent him a short text message, promising to call as soon as I could. As I ran out of the forest, I kept the scoreboard up in the corner of my display so I'd know immediately if Artemis won her joust match and obtained the key. When I finally reached the transport terminal and jumped into the nearest booth, it was just after 2 o'clock in the morning. I entered my destination on the booth's touchscreen, and a map of Middletown appeared on the display. I was prompted to select one of the planet's 256 transport terminals as my arrival point. When Halliday had created Middletown, he hadn't placed just a single recreation of his hometown there. He'd made 256 identical copies of it, spread out evenly across the planet's surface. I didn't think it would matter which copy of his hometown I went to, so I selected one at random near the equator. Then I tapped Confirm to pay the fare, and my avatar vanished. A millisecond later, I was standing inside a vintage 1980s phone booth located inside an old Greyhound bus station. I opened the door and stepped out. It was like stepping out of a time machine. Several NPCs milled around, all dressed in mid-1980s attire. A woman with a giant ozone-depleting hairdo bobbed her head to an oversized Walkman. A kid in a gray members-only jacket leaned against the wall, working on a Rubik's Cube. A mohawked punk rocker sat in a plastic chair, watching a Riptide rerun on a coin-operated television. I located the exit and headed for it, drawing my sword as I went.
The entire surface of Middletown was a PvP zone, so I had to proceed with caution. Shortly after the hunt began, this planet had turned into Grand Central Station, and all 256 copies of Halliday's hometown had been scoured and ransacked by an endless parade of Gunters, all searching for keys and clues. The popular theory on the message boards was that Halliday had created multiple copies of his hometown so that several avatars could search it at the same time without fighting over a single location. Of course, all of this searching had yielded a big, fat donut. No keys, no clues, no egg. Since then, interest in the planet had waned dramatically, but some Gunters probably still came here on occasion. If there was already another Gunter inside Halliday's house when I got there, my plan was to make a run for it, then steal a car and drive 25 miles in any direction to the next identical copy of Middletown, and then the next, until I found an instance of Halliday's house that was unoccupied. Outside the bus station, it was a beautiful Midwestern day. The reddish-orange sun hovered low in the sky. Even though I'd never been to Middletown before, I'd done extensive research on it, so I knew Halliday had coded the planet so that no matter when you visited or where you were on the surface, it was always a perfect late autumn afternoon, circa 1986. I pulled up a map of the town and traced a route from my current location to Halliday's childhood home. It was about a mile to the north. I pointed my avatar in that direction and began to run. Looking around, I was astounded at the painstaking attention to detail. I'd read that Halliday had done all of the coding himself, drawing on his memories to recreate his hometown exactly as it was during his childhood. He'd used old street maps, phone books, photographs, and video footage for reference to make everything as authentic and accurate as possible. The place reminded me a lot of the town in the movie Footloose, small, rural, and sparsely populated. The houses all seemed incredibly big and were placed ridiculously far apart. It astounded me that 50 years ago, even lower-income families had an entire house to themselves. The NPC citizens all looked like extras from a John Cougar Mellencamp video. I saw people out raking leaves, walking dogs, and sitting on porches. Out of curiosity, I waved at a few of them and got a friendly wave in return every time. Clues as to the time period were everywhere. NPC-piloted cars and trucks cruised slowly up and down the shady streets, all of them gas-guzzling antiques. Transams, Dodge Omnis, IROC Z28s, and K-cars. I passed a service station, and the sign said gasoline was only 93 cents a gallon. I was about to turn down Halliday's street when I heard a fanfare of trumpets. My eyes shot over to the scoreboard window, still hovering in the corner of my display. Artemis had done it. Her name now appeared directly below mine. Her score was 9,000 points, 1,000 points less than mine. It appeared that I'd received a bonus for being the first avatar to obtain the copper key. The full ramifications of the scoreboard's existence occurred to me for the first time. From here on out, it would not only allow Gunters to keep track of each other's progress, it would also show the entire world who the current front runners were, creating instant celebrities and targets in the process. I knew, at that exact moment, Artemis must be staring down at her own copy of the copper key, reading the clue engraved on its surface. I was sure she'd be able to decipher it just as quickly as I had. In fact, she was probably already on her way to Middletown right now. That got me moving again. I now had only an hour's head start on her, maybe less. When I reached Cleveland Avenue, the street on which Halliday had grown up, I sprinted down the cracked sidewalk to the front steps of his childhood home. It looked just like the photographs I'd seen, a modest, two-story colonial with red vinyl siding. Two late 70s Ford sedans were parked in the driveway, one of them up on cinder blocks. Looking at the replica Halliday had created of his old house, I tried to imagine what it must have been like for him to grow up there. I'd read that in the real Middletown, Ohio, every house on this street had been demolished in the late 90s to make room for a strip mall. But Halliday had preserved his childhood forever here in the Oasis. I ran up the walkway and entered through the front door, which opened into the living room. I knew this room well because it appeared in Anorak's invitation. I recognized the simulated wood grain paneling, the burnt orange carpet, and garish furniture that looked like it had been scavenged from several disco-era yard sales. The house was empty. For whatever reason, Halliday had decided not to place NPC recreations of himself or his deceased parents here. Perhaps that would have been too creepy, even for him. However, I did spot a familiar family photo on the living room wall. This portrait had been taken at the local Kmart in 1984, but Mr. and Mrs. Halliday were still dressed in late 70s fashions. 12-year-old Jimmy stood between them, glowering at the camera from behind thick eyeglasses. The Hallidays looked like an ordinary American family. There was no hint that the stoic man in the brown leisure suit was an abusive alcoholic, that the smiling woman in the floral pantsuit was bipolar, or that the young boy in the faded Asteroids t-shirt would one day create an entirely new universe. Looking around, I wondered why Halliday, who always claimed to have had a miserable childhood, had later become so nostalgic for it. I knew that if and when I finally escaped from the stacks, I'd never look back, and I definitely wouldn't create a detailed simulation of the place. I glanced over at the bulky Zenith television and the Atari 2600 connected to it. The simulated wood grain on the Atari's plastic casing perfectly matched the simulated wood grain on the television cabinet and on the living room walls. Beside the Atari was a shoebox containing 9 game cartridges: Combat, Space Invaders, Pitfall, Kaboom, Star Raiders, The Empire Strikes Back, Star Master, Yar's Revenge, and E.T. Gunters had attached a large amount of significance to the absence of Adventure, the game Halliday was seen playing on this very same Atari at the end of Anorak's invitation. People had searched the entire Middletown simulation for a copy of it, but there didn't appear to be one anywhere on the whole planet. Gunters had brought copies of Adventure here from other planets, but when they tried to play them on Halliday's Atari, they never worked. So far, no one had been able to figure out why. I did a quick search of the rest of the house and made sure no other avatars were present. Then, I opened the door of James Halliday's room. It was empty, so I stepped inside and locked the door. Screenshots and sim caps of this room had been available for years, and I'd studied all of them closely. But this was my first time standing inside the real thing. I got chills. The carpet was a horrendous mustard color. So was the wallpaper. But the walls were almost entirely covered with movie and rock band posters. Real Genius, War Games, Tron, Pink Floyd, Devo, Rush. A bookshelf stood just inside the door, overflowing with science fiction and fantasy paperbacks, all titles I'd read, of course. A second bookshelf by the bed was crammed to capacity with old computer magazines and Dungeons and Dragons rule books. Several long boxes of comic books were stacked against the wall, each carefully labeled. And there, on the battered wooden desk in the corner, was James Halliday's first computer. Like many home computers of its era, it was housed in the same case as its keyboard. TRS-80, Color Computer 2, 16K RAM, was printed on a label above the keys. Cables snaked out of the back of the machine, leading to an audio cassette recorder, a small color television, a dot matrix printer, and a 300 baud modem. A long list of telephone numbers for dial-up bulletin board systems was taped to the desk beside the modem. I sat down and located the power switch for the computer and the TV. I heard a crackle of static, followed by a low hum as the TV warmed up. A moment later, the TRS-80's green startup screen appeared, and I saw these words: Extended Color Basic 1.1, copyright 1982 by Tandy. Okay. Below this was a flashing cursor, cycling through every color of the spectrum. I typed hello and hit the enter key. Syntax error appeared on the next line. Hello wasn't a valid command in BASIC, the only language the ancient computer understood. I knew from my research that the cassette recorder functioned as the TRS-80's tape drive. It stored data as analog sound on magnetic audio tapes. When Halliday had first started programming, the poor kid hadn't even had access to a floppy disk drive. He'd had to store his code on cassette tapes. A shoebox sat beside the tape drive, filled with dozens of these cassettes. Most of them were text adventure games. Rocketoo, Bedlam, Pyramid, and Madness in the Minotaur. There were also a few ROM cartridges, which fit into a slot on the side of the computer. I dug around in the box until I found a cartridge with Dungeons of Daggerwrath printed in crooked yellow text on its worn red label. The game's artwork depicted a first-person view of a long dungeon corridor blocked by a hulking blue giant with a large stone axe. When a list of the games found in Halliday's bedroom had first appeared online, I'd made sure to download and master every single one of them, so I'd already solved Dungeons of Daggerwrath about 2 years earlier. It had taken most of a weekend. The graphics were crude, but even so, the game was fun and incredibly addictive. I knew from reading the message boards that during the past 5 years, several Gunters had played and solved Dungeons of Daggerwrath right here on Halliday's TRS-80. Some had solved every single game in the shoebox just to see if anything would happen, and nothing had. But none of those Gunters had been in possession of the copper key. My hands were trembling slightly as I powered off the TRS-80 and inserted the Dungeons of Daggerwrath cartridge. When I turned the computer back on, the screen flashed to black, and a crude graphic of a wizard appeared, accompanied by some ominous sound effects. The wizard held a staff in one hand, and below him, printed in all capital letters, was the legend, "I dare ye enter the Dungeons of Daggerwrath." I laid my fingers on the keyboard and began to play. As soon as I did, a jambox sitting on top of Halliday's dresser turned itself on, and familiar music began to blast out of it. It was Basil Poledouris's score for Conan the Barbarian. That must be Anorak's way of letting me know I'm on the right track, I thought. I quickly lost track of time. I forgot that my avatar was sitting in Halliday's bedroom, and that, in reality, I was sitting in my hideout, huddled near the electric heater, tapping at the empty air in front of me, entering commands on an imaginary keyboard. All of the intervening layers slipped away, and I lost myself in the game within the game. In Dungeons of Daggerwrath, you control your avatar by typing in commands, like turn left or get torch, navigating your way through a maze of vector graphic corridors while fighting off spiders, stone giants, blobs, and wraiths as you descend deeper and deeper, working your way down through the dungeon's 5 increasingly difficult levels. It took a while for the commands and quirks of the game to come back to me, but once they did, the game wasn't that difficult to solve. The ability to save my place at any time basically gave me infinite lives, Although saving and reloading games from the tape drive proved to be a slow and tedious process, it often took several attempts and a lot of fiddling with the cassette deck's volume knob. Saving my game also allowed me to log out for bathroom breaks and to recharge my space heater. While I was playing, the Conan the Barbarian score ended, and the jambox clicked over and began to play the opposite side of the tape, treating me to the synthesizer-laden score for Lady Hawk. I couldn't wait to rub H's nose in that. I reached the last level of the dungeon around 4 o'clock in the morning and faced off against the evil wizard of Daggerath. After dying and reloading twice, I finally defeated him using an elvish sword and a ring of ice. I completed the game by picking up the wizard's magic ring, claiming it for myself. As I did, an image appeared on the screen, showing a wizard with a bright star on his staff and his robes. The text below read, "Behold, destiny awaits the hand of a new wizard." I waited to see what would happen. For a moment, nothing did. Then Halliday's ancient dot matrix printer came to life and noisily ground out a single line of text. The tractor feed spooled the page out of the top of the printer. I tore the sheet off and read what was there. "Congratulations! You have opened the first gate." I glanced around and saw that there was now a wrought iron gate embedded in the bedroom wall, in the exact spot where the War Games poster had been a second before. In the center of the gate was a copper-plated lock with a keyhole. I climbed up on top of Halliday's desk so I could reach the lock, then slid the copper key into the keyhole and turned it. The entire gate began to glow, as if the metal had become superheated and its double doors swung inward, revealing a field of stars. It appeared to be a portal into deep space. "My God, it's full of stars," I heard a disembodied voice say. I recognized it as a soundbite from the film 2010. Then I heard a low, ominous hum, followed by a piece of music from that film's score, also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. I leaned forward and looked through the portal, left and right, up and down. Nothing but an endless field of stars in all directions. Squinting, I could also make out a few tiny nebulae and galaxies in the distance. I didn't hesitate. I jumped into the open gate. It seemed to pull me in, and I began to fall. But I fell forward instead of down, and the stars seemed to fall with me. Chapter 11. I found myself standing in an old video arcade, playing Galaga. The game was already in progress. I had double ships and a score of 41,780 points. I glanced down and saw that my hands were on the controls. After a second or two of disorientation, I reflexively began to play, moving the joystick left just in time to avoid losing one of my ships. Keeping one eye on the game, I tried to make sense of my surroundings. In my peripheral vision, I was able to make out a Dig Dug game on my left and a Zaxxon machine to my right. Behind me, I could hear a cacophony of digital combat coming from dozens of other vintage arcade games. Then, as I finished clearing the wave on Galaga, I noticed my reflection in the game's screen. It wasn't my avatar's face I saw there. It was Matthew Broderick's face. A young, pre-Ferris Bueller and pre-Lady Hawk Matthew Broderick. Then I knew where I was and who I was. I was David Lightman, Matthew Broderick's character in the movie War Games, and this was his first scene in the film. I was in the movie. I took a quick glance around and saw a detailed replica of 20 Grand Palace, the combination arcade pizza joint featured in the film. Kids with feathered 80s hairstyles were clustered around each of the games. Others sat in booths, eating pizza and drinking sodas. Video Fever by the Beepers blasted out of a jukebox in the corner. Everything looked and sounded exactly as it did in the movie. Halliday had copied every last detail from the film and recreated it as an interactive simulation. Holy shit. I'd spent years wondering what challenges awaited me inside the first gate. Never once had I imagined this. But I probably should have. War Games had been one of Halliday's all-time favorite movies, which was why I had watched it over 36 times. Well, that, and also because it was completely awesome, with an old-school teenage computer hacker as the protagonist. And it looked like all of that research was about to pay off. Now I heard a repetitive electronic beeping. It seemed to be coming from the right pocket of the jeans I was wearing. Keeping my left hand on the joystick, I reached in my pocket and pulled out a digital watch. The readout said 7:45 a.m. When I pushed one of the buttons to silence the alarm, a warning flashed in the center of my display. David, you're going to be late for school. I used a voice command to pull up my Oasis map, hoping to learn where the gate had transported me. But it turned out that not only was I no longer on Middletown, I was no longer in the Oasis at all. My locator icon was in the middle of a blank screen, which meant I was OTM, off the map. When I'd stepped into the gate, it had transported my avatar into a standalone simulation, a virtual location separate from the Oasis. It seemed that the only way I could get back would be to clear the gate by completing the quest. But if this was a video game, how was I supposed to play it? If this was a quest, what was my goal? I continued to play Galaga while pondering these questions. A second later, a young boy walked into the arcade and came over to me. "Hi, David," he said, his eyes on my game. I recognized this kid from the movie. His name was Howie. In the film, Matthew Broderick's character hands his Galaga game off to Howie when he rushes off to school. "Hi, David," the boy repeated in the same exact tone. As he spoke this time, his words also appeared as text, superimposed across the bottom of my display, like subtitles. Below this, flashing red, were the words, "Final Dialogue Warning." I began to understand. The simulation was warning me that this was my final chance to deliver the next line of dialogue from the movie. If I didn't say the line, I could guess what would probably happen next. Game over. But I didn't panic, because I knew the next line. I'd seen War Games so many times that I knew the entire film by heart. "Hi, Howie," I said, but the voice I heard in my earphones was not my own. It was Matthew Broderick's voice. And as I spoke the line, the warning on my display vanished, and a score of 100 points appeared, superimposed at the top of my display. I racked my brain, trying to mentally replay the rest of the scene. The next line came to me. "How's it going?" I said. And my score jumped to 200 points. "Pretty good," Howie replied. I started to feel giddy. This was incredible. I was totally inside the movie. Halliday had transformed a 50-year-old film into a real-time interactive video game. I wondered how long it had taken him to program this thing. Another warning flashed on my display. "You're going to be late for school, David. Hurry!" I stepped away from the Galaga machine. "Hey, you want to take this over?" I asked Howie. "Sure," he replied, grabbing the controls. "Thanks." A green path appeared on the floor of the arcade, leading from where I stood to the exit. I started to follow it, then remembered to run back and grab my notebook off the Dig Dug game, just like David had in the movie. As I did this, my score jumped another 100 points, and "Action Bonus" appeared on my display. "Bye, David," Howie shouted. "Bye," I shouted back. another 100 points. This was easy. I followed the green path out of 20 Grand Palace and up the busy street a few blocks. I was now running along a tree-lined suburban street. I rounded a corner and saw that the path led directly to a large brick building. The sign over the door said Snohomish High School, David's School, and the setting of the next few scenes in the movie. My mind was racing as I ran inside. If all I had to do was rattle off lines of dialogue from War Games on cue for the next 2 hours, this was going to be a breeze. Without even knowing it, I totally overprepared. I probably knew War Games even better than I knew Real Genius and Better Off Dead. As I ran down the empty school hallway, another warning flashed in front of me. You're late for your biology class. I continued to sprint at top speed, following the green path, which was now pulsing brightly. It eventually led me to the door of a classroom on the second floor. Through the window, I could see that class was already in session. The teacher was up at the board. I saw my seat, the only empty one in the room. It was right behind Ally Sheedy. I opened the door and tiptoed inside, but the teacher spotted me right away. Ah, David, nice of you to join us. Making it all the way to the end of the movie wound up being a lot harder than I anticipated. It only took me about 15 minutes to figure out the rules of the game and to sort out how the scoring system worked. I was actually required to do a lot more than simply recite dialogue. I also had to perform all the actions that Broderick's character performed in the film, in the correct way, and at the correct moment. It was like being forced to act the leading role in a play you'd watched many times, but had never actually rehearsed. For most of the movie's first hour, I was on edge, constantly trying to think ahead to have my next line of dialogue ready. Whenever I flubbed a line or didn't perform an action at the right moment, my score decreased and a warning flashed on my display. When I made two mistakes in a row, a final warning message appeared. I wasn't sure what would happen if I got three strikes in a row, but my guess was that I'd either be expelled from the gate or that my avatar would simply be killed. I wasn't eager to find out which it would be. Whenever I correctly performed seven actions or recited seven lines of dialogue in a row, the game would award me a cue card power-up. The next time I blanked on what to do or say, I could select the cue card icon and the correct action or line of dialogue would appear on my display, sort of like a teleprompter. During scenes that didn't involve my character, the simulation cut to a passive third-person perspective, and all I had to do was sit back and watch things play out, sort of like watching a cutscene in an old video game. During these scenes, I could relax until my character came on screen again. During one of these breaks, I tried to access a copy of the movie from my Oasis console's hard drive with the intention of playing it in a window on my display so I could refer to it, but the system wouldn't let me. In fact, I found that I couldn't open any windows at all while inside the gate. When I tried, I got a warning. No cheating. Try to cheat again, and it's game over. Luckily, it turned out that I didn't need any help. Once I'd collected the maximum of five cue card power-ups, I began to relax, and the game actually started to be fun. It wasn't hard to enjoy being inside one of my favorite flicks. After a while, I even discovered that I could earn bonus points by delivering a line in the exact tone and with the same inflection as in the film. I didn't know it at the time, but I'd just become the first person to play an entirely new type of video game. When GSS got wind of the War Games simulation inside the first gate, and they did a short time later, the company quickly patented the idea and began to buy up the rights to old movies and TV shows and convert them into immersive interactive games that they dubbed FlickSyncs. FlickSyncs became wildly popular. There turned out to be a huge market for games that allowed people to play a leading role in one of their favorite old movies or TV series. By the time I reached the final scenes of the movie, I was starting to get twitchy from exhaustion. I'd now been up for over 24 hours straight, jacked in the entire time. The last action I had to perform was instructing the Whopper supercomputer to play itself at tic-tac-toe. Since every game the Whopper played ended in a tie, this had the improbable effect of teaching the artificially intelligent computer that global thermonuclear war, too, was a game in which the only winning move is not to play. This prevented the Whopper from launching all of the United States ICBMs at the Soviet Union. I, David Lightman, a teenage computer geek from suburban Seattle, had single-handedly prevented the end of human civilization. The NORAD command center erupted in celebration, and I waited for the movie's end credits to roll. But they didn't. Instead, all the characters around me vanished, leaving me alone in the giant war room. When I checked my avatar's reflection in a computer monitor, I saw that I no longer looked like Matthew Broderick. I'd changed back into Parzival. I glanced around the empty NORAD command center, wondering what I was supposed to do next. Then, all of the giant video display screens in front of me went blank, and four lines of glowing green text appeared on them. It was another riddle. The captain conceals the jade key in a dwelling long neglected. But you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected. I stood there for a second, staring at the words in stunned silence. Then I snapped out of my daze and quickly took several screenshots of the text. As I was doing this, the copper gate reappeared, embedded in a nearby wall. The gate was open, and through it I could see Halliday's bedroom. It was the exit. The way out. I'd done it. I'd cleared the first gate. I glanced back up at the riddle on the view screens. It had taken me years to decipher the limerick and locate the copper key. At first glance, this new riddle about the jade key looked like it might take just as long to figure out. I didn't understand a word of it. But I was also dead on my feet and in no condition for further puzzle solving. I could barely keep my eyes open. I jumped through the exit and landed with a thud on the floor of Halliday's bedroom. When I turned around and looked at the wall, I saw that the gate was now gone, and the War Games poster had reappeared in its place. I checked my avatar's stats and saw that I'd been awarded several hundred thousand experience points for clearing the gate, enough to raise my avatar from 10th level up to 20th in one shot. Then I checked the scoreboard. High scores. Number 1, Parzival, 110,000. Number 2, Artemis, 9,000. Numbers 3 through 10, JDH, 0. My score had increased by 100,000 points, and a copper-colored gate icon now appeared beside it. The media, and everyone else, had probably been monitoring the scoreboard since last night, so now the whole world would know that I'd cleared the first gate. I was too exhausted to consider the implications. All I could think about was sleep. I ran downstairs and into the kitchen. The keys to the Halliday family car were on a pegboard next to the refrigerator. I grabbed them and rushed outside. The car, the one that wasn't up on blocks, was a 1982 Ford Thunderbird. The engine started on the second try. I backed out of the driveway and drove to the bus station. From there, I teleported back to the transport terminal next to my school on Lutus. Then I went to my locker and dumped all of my avatar's newfound treasure, armor, and weapons inside before finally logging out of the Oasis. When I pulled off my visor, it was 6:17 a.m. I rubbed my bloodshot eyes and gazed around the dark interior of my hideout, trying to wrap my head around everything that had just happened. I suddenly realized how cold it was in the van. I had been using the tiny space heater off and on all night and had drained the batteries. I was way too tired to get on the exercise bike and recharge them, and I didn't have the energy to make the trek back to my aunt's trailer either. But the sun would be up soon, so I knew I could crash there in my hideout without worrying that I would freeze to death. I slid off of my chair.